Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 23rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Come With Me and Be My Love from Book of John, presented by Fred Nader, number NIF 2006-10. Let's listen in.
And we're sorry for having so much fun at your expense. Welcome to Bible study. On the theme of the summer, I'm Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. And I've been doing a series, actually last week and this week, sort of the same series. Last week I did a series on how each gospel talks about the presence of the risen Christ and how we can recognize, as I've been putting it, where is the risen Christ and what's he done for us lately? How each gospel does that, and all last week I kept saying it would take me an hour to explain this, or it would take me an hour to explain that. So this week I'm taking an hour to explain such things. But some of you who were here last week will obviously recognize large portions of what we'll do today. Most of the gospels use the stories of Jesus' appearances after the resurrection to teach in one way or another where the risen Christ is and what is the risen Christ doing, which was a big question for the early church, both for the insiders and the outsiders. Okay, friends, you say this Jesus of yours is risen. Where is he? So that I may see him also. And I can understand what the risen Christ is doing nowadays. Mark's gospel has the most hidden way of doing that. It chases us back through the gospel rather than giving us any appearance stories whatsoever. All the others have appearance stories, as does John. John's gospel is the multi-layered gospel that does everything in various kinds of figures and metaphors and whatnot. So today, my opening stuff, for lack of a better word, I've been calling it helpful hints and or provisional hilarity. Today I've brought along, just for fun, what alleges to be metaphors and other analogies found in high school writing, in papers written for high school writing classes, collected by English teachers. So I'll just read these and you can make of them what you will. His thoughts tumbled in his head, making and breaking alliances like underpants in a dryer without cling free. They were deeply in love. When he spoke, she thought she heard bells, as if he were a garbage truck backing up. Her vocabulary was as bad as, like, whatever. From the attic came an unearthly howl. The whole scene had an eerie, surreal quality, like when you're on vacation in another city and Jeopardy comes on at 7 instead of 7:30. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. Finally, he spoke with a wisdom that can only come from experience, like a guy who went blind because he looked at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it And he now goes around the country speaking at high schools about the dangers of looking at a soul without one of those boxes where he came over. Very direct. You can't mistake the meaning. Which is not the case with John. With John, it's easy to get misdirected, or maybe John meant to misdirect us some. Well, Marcus Borg, who has taught here at Holden, not lately, but he has been here and taught about the Gospels, and he's written in several of his books that pretty much the whole Gospel of John tells not of the pre-Easter Jesus, but means in the first place to be talking pretty much exclusively about the post-Easter Jesus and how the church of the early period was experiencing the risen Christ, and by extension how every generation post-resurrection will experience the presence of the risen Christ. That would mean that not merely the two chapters of resurrection appearance or post-resurrection appearance stories that we get in John, chapters 20 and 21, should be considered appearance stories like that, but all the way through John, we should be looking at every narrative section as though what we're witnessing is the risen Christ among us. Those of you who were here earlier in the week know that that's a way to read other Gospels too. It's not unique to the way of reading Luke. But what you do find when you try what Borg says is you find, for example, in John 6, the risen Christ feeding the multitudes of his followers, the thousands who go with him into the wilderness journeys where he goes, to feed them ultimately not merely with simple bread, but with the bread that is his own life. Or in the story of the blind man with John, in John 9, it's possible to read that not only as a simple miracle story, but the risen Christ as people come to experience the risen Christ in baptism, but who don't actually immediately get the full significance of their experience except for the risen Christ who then stays with them and follows them around the way Jesus does in the case of that blind man in John 9, and ultimately by Jesus' own faithfulness teaches him what it means to have been baptized. Likewise, it's the risen Christ in John 11 who shows up later than everybody thinks he should in the community of eternal life where someone has died. That's the story of Lazarus. And there too, it's the story of the baptized who are newly raised, whom the risen Christ sees through the next crises of their lives. If we had a lot of time, we could see that John 11 is extraordinarily complex, and what you have there is a person who has been raised to a new life, which is what we say about ourselves when we're baptized, but he's still living in his grave clothes. It's hard to walk that way. Just think about it. Grave clothes in ancient times were linen strips wrapped around you, making you almost into a mummy, and how would you walk out of a grave if you were dressed like that? So obviously Jesus has to say to this man's friends, unbind him and let him go. And the verbs there that Jesus says in that moment are the same verbs used elsewhere in John and in the other Gospels for the forgiveness of sins. The language of unbinding and unloosing is the language of forgiveness in other contexts, only we translate the verbs slightly differently. But they're the same ones. And so it's the practice, the ongoing practice of the forgiveness of sins that the community aids a person in their post-baptismal life that allows them finally to walk, to live the life of faith. And so the risen Christ is also a part of that work in John's gospel. So those are just some examples of how we could go through every story and see how what we're really looking at is the work of the risen Christ among us. John's gospel begins and ends with a theology for lack of a better word, witness. We have all sorts of nesses these days, truthiness. We're talking about witness here. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. We hear at the beginning, and a few verses later in verse 14, chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we have beheld his glory. So the Word was with the Father, and now the Word is with us, which means by the time we get to verse 18, no one has ever seen God, but the only Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, has made him known. So the fact that the Word, who was with God, is now with us, makes us with God. So all this witness happens through the one who is the Word incarnate, who is both with God and with us. But then at the end of John's Gospel, we get two whole chapters of post-resurrection stories. And I thought that's where we'd go for a while this morning. So if you do have a Bible and you want to be following along, it's John 20 that we'll spend a few moments on each portion of this and try to see how we can experience the risen Christ. It sounds like the crucifixion is still going on. Next door there. Not surprising. In a community of Christians, right? Early on the first day of the week, it's still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So in John, it's only Mary Magdalene. In the other Gospels and the Synoptics, it's a group of women who go out there. But that group of women, by the way, has to take care of all the burial the parts of the burial routines that weren't handled due to the haste they needed to work with. But in John's Gospel, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, the two people who handled the burial in John's Gospel, have taken care of all those things already. That's another whole interesting thing we could do with John. John has these two people who wouldn't be seen with Jesus in broad daylight. They're the ones who boldly come out of the woodwork after Jesus is dead, and they claim his dead body. So what's that all about? People who wouldn't be seen with him in life are now willing to be seen with him when he's dead. But Mary doesn't have to handle all of that. She just comes out to the tomb for her own reasons and finds that the stone has been removed. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they've laid him." Peter and the other disciple set out and went to the tomb. The two were running together. The other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And if you know the Gospel of John well, you know that this is always happening, that Peter is always losing races to this other guy. This other fellow is closer to Jesus and first at everything, and Peter is always one step removed. Peter isn't even the first disciple chosen in John's Gospel, but his brother gets chosen and goes and finds Peter and says, "Come with me." So Peter is always second, or third, or fourth. The disciple whom Jesus loved bent down to look in and saw the linen cloth lying there and didn't go in. Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen wrapped and lying there, the clothes that had been on Jesus' head. Then the other disciple who reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed. So Peter just lost another race. Peter sees first, but the other guy believes first. And you know about seeing and believing, and the relationship of those things. And John will get another snippet of that later, but that's a big deal that the other guy believed, even though Peter saw first. They didn't yet know about the scriptures, that he must rise from the dead, so they went home. Oh, this was interesting. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And now we're at the part where we can ask our question, how do we know the risen Christ in our midst? As Mary wept, she bent over to look into the tomb. She saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said, "They've taken my Lord. I don't know where they've laid him." She turns around and sees Jesus standing there, but she did not know that it was Jesus. So once again, as in all the Gospels that have such stories, you can look right at Jesus post-resurrection and not know who it is. It's what happened to Emmaus and Matthew. We didn't dwell on this yesterday, but when they go to the mountain to which Jesus directs them, the disciples, they kind of doubt. They doubt something. They either doubt who this is, or maybe they doubt whether they're in the right place or something, but there's uncertainty in every one of the stories about exactly what they're experiencing. So Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" Asks the same question as the messengers. Who are you looking for? Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've taken him, and I'll take him." Jesus simply says her name, Mary. She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabuni," which means teacher. Jesus says, "Don't hold on to me." There's a lot of famous paintings. They all have Latin titles, "Noli me tangere." Not exactly "don't touch me," but don't grab me, don't seize me, don't hold me.
Question.
Yeah?
Which Mary are we talking about? Mother of Jesus or Mary Magdalene?
Mary Magdalene.
Thank you.
This is Mary Magdalene. And Jesus says, "I've not yet ascended to my Father. That's why you can't touch me. But go to my brothers and say to them, I'm ascending to my God and your to my Father and your Father, my God and your God." So she went and announced to the disciples, "I've seen the Lord." And she told them about these things. So what's the answer for how you can recognize the risen Christ? What sense do you make of that in John's Gospel? What is this little, I mean, obviously it's, he speaks by name. But what are we supposed to, if this is supposed to be about us as well, how can we know the presence of the risen Christ in our midst? He can be right there with you in the places where you weep and you won't recognize him. How can you know who he is?
Seems like there was some compassion for her.
Okay, we could. That would somewhat depend, since that kind of thing isn't mentioned. It would depend how we intoned her speaking of. I read it very gently, Mary. I mean, we could read it as him saying, "Mary!" "Get a grip!" playful, but, you know, I read what you said into it because that's how I've always assumed it, that he is being gentle. And I don't know any other.
Fred.
Yeah.
Listen.
Just talking with him isn't, I mean, like if we, when we pray, is that she's talking with him, she's engaged in a relationship with him when she first sees him.
Okay, so just talking.
And yeah. Listening.
Okay. Okay, wait a minute.
He revealed himself.
Well, he does. He does reveal himself by means of speaking her name. It's the sound, it's audible, it's the sound of his voice, somehow or another, speaking her name.
And on the road to Emmaus?
On the road to Emmaus, it was breaking of bread, it was Bible study. There are more things to see and to hear than we have here.
It's kind of strange that the disciples didn't see the angels in the tomb. Mary saw them immediately after that. They didn't see the gardener or the person in the garden either, which is that big of a carry.
Yeah.
So she wanted to see Christ, maybe.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, we could spend a long time just examining what each person in the story sees. Mary sees angels. The two disciples only saw grave clothes. Mary sees angels. Mary sees Jesus.
I think it's sort of like I have a vision of a door, and Jesus on one side, Mary on the other side. You can either pound on the door and have someone open it, or you can tap lightly, or you can choose not to open the door. Jesus did either pound on the door or tap on the door by saying her name.
Yeah.
And she either wistfully opened it or gently opened it, but that did happen, so it's not really a...
Yeah.
That's how I vision it.
Yeah.
Fred?
Yeah?
My sheep know my voice.
Yeah. Yeah, if we look for clues elsewhere in the Gospel of John, that's the most helpful place probably to end up. One of the things about John's gospel, unlike Matthew, for example, Matthew says over and over and over again, this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, da 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 da. 11 of those and more than a dozen others that don't have the formula that leads up to them. In John's gospel, over and over again, Jesus makes his own prophecies about himself and then fulfills them. He says, for example, in chapter 12, when he comes to town and some Greeks want to see him, and he decides that's the clue that now the hour has come, and he says, now is the Son of Man glorified, now is the hour, and I, when I am lifted up, will draw all people to myself. And then the narrator pauses to tell us he said this to show by what death he was to die. So sometimes the narrator stops us to make sure that we recognize that Jesus is making prophecies about his own life. And sure enough, in John's gospel, he does get raised up and draws all people to himself, and his prophecy works out. He says, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have the power to lay it down. And sure enough, in John's gospel, he fulfills that prophecy. He does everything by his own, at his own direction. He takes over every scene, and he dies crying out, it is finished, it worked, I did it. So he fulfills his own prophecies. And yeah, as Renita says back in chapter 10, in the Good Shepherd Discourses, he says, my sheep know my voice, and they follow me. So all he has to do is speak the name, and his sheep know his voice. And notice she doesn't say, oh, Jesus, it's you. She says, Rabuni, my teacher. That word sort of means master, my great one. Rabbi, Rav, really means exalted one, great one. So It's a title, and it's what hearing his voice does for a believer, for one of his own. So, how do you get named?
At baptism.
All right, that's as obvious a reference as we could find. It's the reminders of our baptism. You know, being named by means of the name to which we have been connected with Christ by baptism.
Is that John language?
Well, John has a little bit different way of working with baptism than the other Gospels, but I don't know. I mean, we're extrapolating some in how the early Christian community would have understood naming, but yeah. Can anybody think of another way that hearing our names?
Well, if Jesus is teacher, then we hear our name as student or learner or.
I heard an interesting comment recently that when giving nicknames to somebody, this person's opinion was that gives you power over them. And it made me, what you were talking about now, made me think naming something that gives you, you own it or it joins, you join with it. Like we name our children, you join with it. There's an ongoing conversation now. I kept my last name, but people get married and change their names to join with. And we did something symbolic with our names, kind of mixed them all up, to demonstrate a joining with without giving up our birth name. So it joins you with, and it could be power over.
Yeah, yeah.
Adam names the animals, and in some sense enters into relationship and stewardship.
Yeah.
Name is one particular word that associates you, and Jesus was that one particular word that came to associate with us. So then when he speaks Mary's name, there's a particular association.
Yeah.
Fred, I'm thinking in the church, in the life of the church, when we know each other's name, we know the names of the children in our congregation, when an adult mentor takes the trouble to learn the name of a confirmation student, I think that's a real sign of the presence of Christ.
And if we went looking for these things, almost everything everyone has said, we would find hints of stuff like that in the scriptural tradition. Going all the way back to the naming that goes on in Genesis. And we know John's gospel is very much interested in Genesis because that's where it starts. In the beginning was the word. And naming is such a big thing. We don't have time to do a theology of naming in Genesis, but it's way more complicated than it looks. And among other things, the word for naming is really the word for calling. And it has to be done out loud, because it's also the word for reading in Hebrew, kara, and it's the way the naming happens in Genesis. The implication of the way the verbs work is you are what that calling out says you are so long as that calling continues. And that's one of God's ongoing activities, is naming you, and you stay who you are so long as God keeps calling you, keeps naming you, keeps saying that's who you are. So, you know, this is also the giving of identity. So,
thinking of as a deep mystery that what goes on in those two small words, Mary and Mary's response.
Yeah.
Jesus has to call her. And then she has to have her hearing on. Her vision only took her so far. Mm-hmm. And happily, he was a teacher that said, "My student isn't hearing me. I'll say it in a different way." And
yeah.
He called her name, and she responded.
Yeah. Yeah. he's actually calling her almost out of her own grave. He's calling her back to life.
But when Jesus was speaking to the woman at the well, I don't recall him giving her a name, but he spoke to her as if that he knew her. He knew who she was. And
right.
When you were reading the passage just now, even before the fact that he mentioned Mary's name, the first thing I thought of is that Mary, that he knew her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this man knows who I am.
Right. So again, this is the post-Easter Jesus, you know, who, there too. And we're going to that story, by the way, and if we get there, the story of the Samaritan woman. Maybe let's move on. I think we could do a lot more with this naming, but it's, I mean, we've done enough to see that this is really rich with ways to think about the risen Christ revealing himself to us, even in the here and now. The next scene is at least as famous, and maybe more so, because this scene with first the whole group of disciples and then with Thomas is the gospel lesson for the Sunday after Easter every single year, all 3 years of the lectionary cycle, so we get this one annually. It's still the same day, the first day of the week. The doors of the house where the disciples had met was locked for fear of, however you translate it, the Judeans, the Jews, the locals. Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And the implication is that he comes without benefit of whatever it is you usually need to enter locked doors. And so Jesus has just told Mary, "I'm ascending." And we're now, between that moment and this one, we are to understand that the ascension happened. And Jesus is now not hindered by the boundaries of space and time. So whereas Luke has the ascension happen 50 days later, in John it happens this very day. Jesus can now appear anywhere. Not that he couldn't in Luke, because, you know, he skipped out on supper in Emmaus pretty easily. We recall. But here he suddenly can stand in a place, and I don't want to spend that much time on the early scene. He greets the disciples, shows them his hands and his side. He gives them a commission. First he breathes on them. That's Pentecost. Jesus breathes his breath. That's his ruach, his pneuma, his spirit. The Spirit of Christ is now breathed upon this group of disciples, and what are they empowered to do? Forgive sins. This is the equivalent of that thing in Matthew. They now have the power to unlock everything that needs unlocking, including the gates of hell. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, wasn't there. And you know how this scene works. Thomas says, "Unless I can see and unless I can touch, I won't believe." And later on, Jesus will come and give him that opportunity. I think the key to, or one of the keys to the scene, is figuring out who is Thomas's twin. Because that's a piece of unnecessary information. Why do we have to hear at this point that he is not just Thomas, but Thomas Didymus? Thomas the twin. Because, well, I don't know, who, you ever thought about that or heard speculation on that or figured that out? Or some people say he was Jesus' twin, that he was a lookalike. Not that he was literally Jesus' birth mate, but that he was the one who looked so much like Jesus, they could have faked the resurrection.
Is that Dan Brown by
chance? Pardon me?
Dan Brown maybe said that.
That's the kind of thing Dan Brown would have said. And we're going to prove Dan Brown partly right in a moment, but anyway. Maybe he had a twin somewhere. I mean, maybe this is a throwaway, but I don't believe in throwaways. So I think we're supposed to be able to identify the twin. And personally, to make a long story short, because time's a fleeting, I think Thomas is the twin of everyone else who ever says, you guys were there, I wasn't. If I could have a chance to see him for myself and touch the wounds and feel his breath on my face like you guys did, I could believe too, but I just can't. Which is obviously everyone since that moment who wasn't there, including every one of us. I mean, haven't you ever thought that? This would be a whole lot easier if I could have been there and seen and touched. So Thomas is our twin. He's the twin of every generation who wasn't there. Okay, so what do we twins of Thomas get? Well, the risen Christ comes in without benefit of a way to get through locked doors. He enters the places of fear and doubt. And what does he say to all Thomas's twins, to Thomas and all his twins? Put your finger here in my hands. See. But see what? Everything revolves around those wounds. And in John's gospel, particularly the wound of his side is a wound that's not just the gratuitous behavior of a soldier who's been cheated out of his chance to make sure someone was dead. But in John's gospel, it's the sign that Jesus is the Passover lamb. He is the Lamb of God who has taken away the sin of the world. And for that, you need to understand that the whole Gospel of John chronology is different, and Jesus dies the day before Passover at the same moment as the Passover lambs. And he does become the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. As the one prophecy that John quotes after the slash in the side, a fountain has been opened up for the forgiveness and the cleansing of Israel. So these wounds are the sign that Jesus' death was a salvific death. But even risen from the dead, Jesus still has these wounds. You know, wrecked feet and what Frederick Buechner calls ruined hands. Forever, he's the one of ruined hands. The body of Christ is wounded even now. How can you touch the wounds of the risen Christ? Except through contact with the wounds of the body of Christ that is present here in this room. It is through the peace of Christ. Whenever he comes to you and says, peace be with you, look at my hands. We offer each other the peace of Christ, extending to each other our wounded hands. And I don't think this is all that far of a stretch. I mean, that part of what we're to see here is the community embodying the risen Christ, offering each other the peace of Christ. That's as much of Christ as I've ever seen, is you.
as you were reading this, Tom and I have moved a lot, and it seems like every place we go, someone kind of appears to be a mentor. It's rather interesting as you were reading through that, it came through the doors, like they appear, you don't expect this person. And the one who is helping me now is about 80 years old, and she kind of said when she first got to know me, I don't know if I like this person, she's kind of rough here and there. But she kind of stuck in there, and she's kind of pushed me here and there, and I think that's kind of interesting. Whoever you might think is your mentor might be.
Yeah.
That kind of thing coming.
Yeah, I like that. That's good.
Is peace be with you, is that like a common greeting?
That's what everybody said. That's what you said. They still say it. Shalom Aleichem. And what is it in Arabic? It's very
Shalom
similar.
Aleichem.
What?
Shalom Aleichem.
Yeah. It's the common for millennia. That's been how you greet someone. But that greeting is forever changed in this moment. That's why we're still saying it. And it almost always involves your hands. Well, it's 16 minutes till 10, and I've got 40 minutes of stuff. That I wish I could say we're not going to get all that done. I'm going to do a little bit of hit-and-run theology for a moment here, and then we'll plunk back down at a different spot. Jesus turns to the... He breaks character like a man on a stage after talking to Thomas, and he turns to the audience, and then he says, "Blessed are those who have not seen..." Get it? "And yet have believed." And then John has a perfectly good ending. There are many other things that Jesus did, and but they are not all written here. This much is written, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and believing have life. And then we get a whole other chapter, which if it wasn't there, you would never miss it, because John is perfectly complete without it. But in that next chapter, we get a revised version of what Luke did back in Luke 5 in the story of how the disciples get called in Luke, when we have the great draft of fish that doesn't get hauled in until Jesus directs them. These seasoned fishermen take fishing instructions from a carpenter. And it works. And now it happens again, only this is a post-resurrection story, complete with all the business about not recognizing Jesus. They kind of want to ask, "Who are you?" But, oh, they knew who it was. Well, then why'd they want to ask? Somebody has to tell Peter it's the Lord, in which case he puts on his clothes in order to swim to shore. So there's all sorts of oddities going on. But the point of the story is... And by now, you know, John knows that we know Luke, and that we'll connect fishing to mission, and that the net that they're dragging through the sea that catches not just a bunch of fish, but 153 fish. And no throwaways, I said. Jerome, when he wrote a commentary, when he translated the Bible of Jerome, said that he once heard that 153 was the total number of species known by the Galilean fishermen in all the years they had fished that body of water. That's how many different kinds they'd hauled out of there. And yet the nets did not break. And what is Jesus' role? Well, they're the ones catching all the fish, but Jesus has fish to feed them. So where is the risen Christ and what is he doing? He is directing the mission, and he is the feeder and the sustainer of the disciples as they go on their mission as the fishers of people hauling the dragnet of the gospel through the world. This net that's big enough for everybody, and yet it won't be torn.
Fred, the detail was the fact that, that Peter puts on his clothes. I knew the text says he was naked. I don't know anything about fishing at that time. And while that makes maybe some sense in terms of you getting so sloshed with water, that maybe they could do that. Nevertheless, nakedness was shame for the Hebrew folk.
Well, I mean, I made it sound funny because it's the opposite of what we would think. But the truth is that working out on those boats, they wouldn't have worn...
They wouldn't have worn much.
Their regular clothes, and what he's really doing is getting dressed to go meet somebody. I mean, it's not that. I made him sound dumber than he is.
But is there something to the fact that sometimes in our total nakedness and our openness, in our who we are, by gosh, we see Christ? And
yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
He catches us that way.
Yeah. It's interesting that he would go, that he, well, yeah. I don't know. That's...
You know, the NIV says he wrapped his outer garment around him before he had taken it off. The Living Bible said he was stripped to the waist.
And this one says stripped for work.
Well, yeah, I mean, the NRSV simply says naked, so I don't have my Greek with me this morning. If somebody does, is it just gymnos? Okay, I think we're stuck on this one. Yeah. I'm going to just insist that we move on. There's one really wonderful thing for sure that I want to make sure that you have noticed. Well, a couple things. Jesus plays with his own absence and presence in John's Gospel. I count four different times Jesus tells the disciples or other people, I'm going away and you can't come along. Where I'm going, you can't come. And it confuses everybody. They all say, well, where are you going then? Or tell us where you're going, or tell us how to get there, or something like that. And sometimes Jesus says things like, well, if you still don't know the way after all this time I've been with you, then what's the matter with you? And other times it's just flat out, there's no way you can know. Don't even worry about it. And last week I was pondering all the ways Jesus might have intoned that, you know, like I did with the name. You know, like, is it philosophical? I'm going away and you can't go there. Or is it childlike taunting? I'm going away and you can't come. Or how, you know, how are we supposed to hear this? But then later on, there's this amazing thing that Jesus does when in chapter 14 he says, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And of course, at least as children, the first thing we think of is Jesus is going ahead to get heaven ready for us. And he's got to get the place ready, like Jesus is the head housekeeper of heaven. And, you know, the beds need to be made or something. The harps cleaned or whatever. But then, following that, John does a whole bunch of place naming. And he's very careful to use the word place in several spots where you wouldn't really need to use the word place. Jesus went to prepare a place, and those places turn out to be, chapter 18, verse 2, the place that Judas, who betrayed him, also knew. John 19, 13, there is the place called the stone pavement, or in Hebrew, Gabbatha, where Jesus was sentenced to die. 19:17, the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha, and finally 19:41, the place nearby where they laid him because there wasn't time to find another tomb. Those are all the places also that Jesus went ahead to prepare for us so that they would be ready when we got there, because we're going to every one of those places too, and they need to be ready. Because sooner or later, each of us is going to also be betrayed by something or someone. If nothing else, by some silent killer or another that sneaks up on us and hands us over. And we too are going to die, sentenced to death in some place or another, and we are going to be left behind in some place while the rest of the world goes on about its business without us. And so each of those places is ready as well, and the risen Christ awaits us in each one of them. Or as Luther says when he talks about the descent to hell, what this means is there is no place I could go except that even there he is Lord for me. So those places are ready. And I love playing with that kind of theology. And if you think, there's not time. I do want to do one more thing briefly in 6 minutes, and that is to give you another way that we have an intimate presence of the risen Christ in our lives in the baptismal community. And this is the part where I want to tell you that Dan Brown was partly right. In the Da Vinci Code, Jesus was married. Still is, in fact. And Mary Magdalene is included. It's by means of the story of this Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 that we can discover this, and I'm going to have to do this quickly. I'm sorry about that. It's fun to drag this out and see exactly how this works. In John chapter 3, near the end, John the Baptist tells people this has been going on a while with John the Baptist. He tells them yet again, I am not the Messiah. And this is part of an agenda having to do with the fact that many people did think in the early days that John was the Messiah, not Jesus. And every gospel has its way of saying even John recognized he was not the Messiah. But John says, I'm not the Messiah. He says, think of it this way. I'm the best man at the wedding, and the bridegroom is already at the door, as it were, and I'm thrilled that the bridegroom is here. And the very next story we have is John 4, in which Jesus, traveling outside his own territory up in Samaria, sits down by a well, and it was noon, and a woman walks up to the place and asks, and Jesus asks her a question. And if you know anything about stories like the one that's about to unfold, you know very well that in that moment, Jesus' pulse quickened. Or if it didn't, it should have. Because any Jewish man who knows his Bible knows that something extraordinary is about to happen with him sitting by a well outside his home territory, and a woman walks up and they speak, because this had happened to so many of the ancestors. The scholar that helped people to understand these kinds of stories is Robert Alter in his book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, who has helped people to see that all these stories like this in the Bible are type scenes. Homer scholars were the people who figured out how these type scenes work and have helped us to see that they happen in the Bible as well. Very quickly, Abraham sends his servant to find a wife for Isaac. The servant prays that a scenario might unfold that would reveal a wife to him, and he goes to a well. He comes to a well back in the old country where he's been dispatched to find a wife from among our people so that Isaac doesn't have to marry one of the Hittites who would drive us nuts. And sure enough, when the servant, even as he prayed, comes to this well, up comes a woman and does exactly what he prayed might be the sign. Rebecca comes. They speak. Rebecca runs home and tells her family, "I met this guy." And they say, "Well, where is he? Bring him here." And the servant goes and they have all sorts of talk about a lot of financial things in this case. They ask Rebecca if she'll go. She says yes. And Isaac has a bride. Very next generation, Jacob fleeing from his brother's wrath because he's cheated his brother. Comes to a well back in the homeland to which he's fled, and along comes the beautiful Rachel, who steals his heart in an instant. They talk. She runs home and says, "I met this guy." They say, "Where is he? Bring him here." Jacob goes. They talk, and he gets a bride. Actually, gets two brides. He gets more marriage than he was hoping for. And that's the story of his life. A little bit too much of everything, and a lot of trouble with it. Just like Isaac, you know, wasn't even there for his own betrothal, but he's Mr. Passive, and that's the story of his life. You know, then Moses, a couple generations later, you know, he's fleeing for his life because he's killed somebody, and he's out there in the middle of nowhere, and he comes to this well, and these women show up to water their flocks. They're harassed. He saves them from these marauding shepherds. They run home and say, "I met this guy." They say, "Where is he? Bring him here." He goes, and he leaves with Reuel's daughter, Zipporah, for his wife. So this is what happens to you if you stop at a well. You're about to be married. There's a whole bunch of these. Saul gets half of one. He gets all short-circuited at the well and goes off in the wrong direction and never actually makes it to the well. And that's what happens to his life. It goes sideways at that point. He loses. There's a backwards one in Ruth. Ruth, the foreign woman, comes in and gets water from Boaz's guys at the well, ends up at dinner and betrothed, you know. So it's a reverse one of these stories. So here's Jesus at the well. The woman comes. They talk. It's a lot of talk, and we don't have time for all that, but she runs home, and she says, "I met this guy. He told me everything." They say, "Well, where is he? Bring him here." He goes. They talk. But Jesus' story is strange, just like all the others are strange in some way or another, because he doesn't get his bride. But he will. Right? There will come another time later on in John's Gospel when again, precisely at noon, he will ask for a drink. In John's Gospel, Jesus is crucified not at 9 in the morning like in the Synoptics, but at noon. And at noon, and only in John, he says, "I thirst." And he gets a drink. He doesn't take a drink from the other guy. He refuses it. In John's Gospel, he takes a drink. And what it is, it's named in the Greek as oxus, which is not oinos, which is good wine. Oxus is sour wine. It's wine vinegar, we call it. Stuff that workers carried around and had handy at places like, well, any place. You know, the soldiers probably carried it so they didn't get Hezekiah's revenge. give him a drink of this on hyssop. Dripping wine from a stick on a sponge. And he takes it. That's his wedding drink. Because Jesus gets his bride, just like everything else comes to fruition. On the cross, Jesus takes his bride. And of course, who is his bride? The book of Revelation names his bride. Another piece of Johannine literature. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. God will dwell with them. They will be God's peoples, and God will be with them. So we are the bride. All the baptized, dressed as bride, to meet their bridegroom. Link up with Jesus, whose betrothal is complete at the cross. So that's how the risen, another way that the risen Christ is present in the intimacy of marriage.
What's the name of the author again you mentioned?
Robert Alter, The Art of Biblical Narrative.
Say again?
Robert Alter, A-L-T-E-R.
Okay.
Robert Alter, The Art of Biblical Narrative. Well, we're out of time. I have all the whole history of this Samaritan woman and her friends, which is us. You know, she'd been through 5 different relationships. I mean, her life story would be a little bit like that movie, The Red Violin, or Annie Proulx's accordion novel. You know, she just got passed on and passed on and passed on. And just like us who have been around the block in multiple places and relationships and whatnot until we become the bride of Christ. But that's how we are with him. And I guess that's the end, because we have to have...